Diane Bray's been murdered, Fielding said. It's all over the news. They've got a suspect in custody. Detective Anderson. 39. It was very overcast, and rain had begun to fall when we reached Windsor Farms, and it seemed bizarre to be driving the office's black Suburban past Georgian brick and Tudor homes on gracious acres beneath old trees. I'd never known my neighbors to worry much about crime. It seemed old family money and genteel streets with English names had created a fortress of false security. I had no doubt that was about to change. Diane Bray's address was at the outer limits of the neighborhood, where the downtown expressway ran loudly and continuously on the other side of a brick wall. When I turned onto her narrow street, I was dismayed. Reporters were everywhere. Their cars and television trucks blocked traffic and outnumbered police vehicles 3-1 in front of a white Cape Cod with a gambrel roof that looked like it belonged in New England. "This is as close as I can get," I said to Marino. "We'll see about that," he replied, jerking up his door handle. He got out in heavy rain and stalked over to a radio van that was halfway on the lawn in front of Bray's house. The driver rolled down his window and was foolish enough to poke his microphone Marino's way. "Move," Marino said with violence in his voice. "Captain Marino, can you verify? Move your fucking van now!" Tires spun, clawing up grass and mud as the driver of the van pulled out. He stopped in the center of the street and Marino kicked the back tire. "Move!" he ordered. The van driver rolled away, windshield wipers flying. He parked on someone's lawn 2 houses away. Rain whipped my face, and strong gusts of wind pushed me like a hand as I got my scene case out of the back of the Suburban. "I hope your latest act of graciousness doesn't make it on the air," I said when I reached Marino. "Who the hell's working this thing?" "I hope you are," I said, walking fast with head bent. Marino grabbed my arm. A dark blue Ford Contour was parked in Bray's driveway. A patrol car was parked behind it, an officer in front, another in back with Anderson. She looked angry and hysterical, shaking her head and talking fast in words I couldn't hear. "Dr. Scarpetta?" A television reporter headed toward me, the cameraman on his heels. "Recognize our rental car?" Marino quietly said to me, water running down his face as he stared at the dark blue Ford with the familiar number RGG7112 on the license plate. "Dr. Scarpetta, no comment." Anderson didn't look at us as we walked past. "Can you tell?" Reporters were relentless. "No," I said, hurrying up the front steps. "Captain Marino, I understand the police were led here by a tip." Rain smacked and engines rumbled. We ducked under the yellow crime scene tape stretching from railing to railing. The door suddenly swung open and an officer named Butterfield let us in. "Glad as hell to see you," he said to both of us. "Thought you were on vacation," he added to Marino. "Yeah, I got vacated, you're right." We put on gloves and Butterfield shut the door behind us. His face was tight, his attention going everywhere. "Tell me about it," Marino said, eyes sweeping the foyer and zooming into the living room beyond. "Got a 911 call made from a phone booth not too far from here. We get here, and this is what we find. Someone beat the holy hell out of her," Butterfield said. "What else?" Marino asked. "Sexual assault. Looks like robbery, too. Billfold on the floor, no money in it, everything in her purse dumped out. Watch where you step," he added, as if we didn't know better. "Damn, she had big bucks, no kidding," Marino marveled, looking around at the very expensive furnishings of Bray's very expensive home. "You ain't seen nothing yet," Butterfield replied. What struck me first was the collection of clocks in the living room. There were wall clocks and hanging shelf clocks in rosewood, walnut, and mahogany, and calendar and steeple clocks and novelty clocks, all of them antique and perfectly synchronized. They tick-tocked loudly and would have driven me mad were I to live amidst their monotonous reminder of time. She was fond of English antiques that were grand and unfriendly. A scroll-end sofa and a revolving bookcase with dummy leather book dividers faced the TV. Placed here and there with no thought of company in mind, it seemed, were stiff armchairs with ornate upholstery and a satinwood pole screen. A massive ebonized sideboard overpowered the room. The heavy gold damask draperies were drawn, and cobwebs laced box-pleated valances. I saw no art, not a single sculpture or painting, and with every detail I took in, Bray's personality became colder and more overbearing. I liked her less. That was hard to acknowledge about someone who had just been beaten to death. "Where did she get her money?" I asked. "Got no idea," Marino answered. "All of us been wondering that ever since she came here," Butterfield said. "You ever seen her car?" "No," I replied. "Huh," Marino retorted. "She takes a brand new Crown Vic home with her every night." "A damn Jaguar. Fire engine red. In the garage. Looks like a 98 or 99. Can't even guess what that cost." The detective shook his head. "About 2 years of your working ass," Marino commented. "Tell me." They talked on about Bray's tastes and wealth as if her battered, dead body didn't exist. I saw no evidence that an encounter had occurred in the living room, or that anyone even used it much or bothered to clean it thoroughly. The kitchen was off the living room to the right, and I glanced inside it, again checking for blood or any other sign of violence, and finding none. The kitchen did not feel lived in either. Countertops and the stove were spotless. I saw no food, only a bag of Starbucks coffee and a small wine rack holding 3 bottles of Merlot. Marino came up from behind and edged past me through the doorway. He opened the refrigerator with gloved hands. "Doesn't look like she was into cooking," he said, scanning sparsely stocked shelves. I surveyed a quart of 2% milk, tangerines, margarine, a box of grape nuts and condiments. The freezer held no more promise. "It's like she was never home, or ate out all the time," he said, stepping on a pedal to pop up the trash can lid. He reached inside and pulled out pieces of a torn-up Domino's pizza box, a wine bottle, and 3 St. Pauli Girl beer bottles. He pieced together fragments of the receipt. 1 medium pepperoni extra cheese," he mumbled. "Ordered last night at 5:53. He dug around some more and found crumpled napkins, 3 slices of the pizza, and at least 6 cigarette butts. "Now we're cooking," he said. "Bray didn't smoke. Looks like she had company last night."
"When did the 911 call come in?"
9:04, about 1.5 hours ago. "And it don't look to me like she was up making coffee, reading the paper, or anything else this morning." "I'm pretty sure she was already dead by this morning," Butterfield offered.
We moved on, following a carpeted hallway to the master bedroom in the back of the house. When we reached the open doorway, both of us stopped. Violence seemed to absorb all light and air. Its silence was complete, its stains and destruction everywhere.
"Holy shit," Marino said under his breath.
Whitewashed walls, floor, ceiling, overstuffed chairs, chaise longue, were spattered so completely with blood it almost seemed part of a decorator's plan. But these droplets, smears, and streaks weren't dye or paint. They were fragments from a terrible explosion caused by a psychopathic human bomb. Dried speckles and drips sullied antique mirrors, and the floor was thick with coagulated puddles and splashes. The king-size bed was soaked with blood and oddly stripped of its linens. Diane Bray had been beaten so severely I couldn't have told her race. She was on her back, green satin blouse and black underwire bra on the floor. I picked them up. They had been ripped from her body. Every inch of skin was dried wipes and smears and swirls, reminding me of finger painting again, her face a mush of splintered bone and battered tissue. On her left wrist was a smashed gold watch. On her right ring finger, a gold band was beaten into the bone. For a long time, we stared. She was naked from the waist up. Her black corduroy pants and belt didn't seem to have been touched. The soles of her feet and her palms were chewed up, and this time Loup-Garou didn't bother eradicating his bite marks. They were circles of widely spaced, narrow teeth that didn't look human. He had bitten and sucked and beaten, and Bray's complete degradation, her mutilation especially of her face, instantly screamed rage. It cried out that she might have known her killer,
just as Lou Garou's other murders had. Only he didn't know them. Before he showed up at the door, he and his victims had never met except in his hellish fantasies. "What's wrong with Anderson?" Marina was asking Butterfield.
"She heard about it and freaked."
"That's kinda interesting. That mean we don't got a detective here?"
"Marino, let me see your flashlight, please," I said.
I shone the light all around. Blood was spattered on the headboard and a bedside lamp, caused when the impact of blows or slashes projected small droplets away from the weapon. There were low-velocity stains as well, blood that had dripped to the carpet. I got down and probed the bloody hardwood floor next to the bed, and I found more pale long hairs. They were on Bray's body, too.
"The word we got was to secure the scene and wait for a supervisor," one of the cops was saying.
"What supervisor?" Marino asked. I shone light obliquely on bloody footprints close to the bed. They had a distinctive tread, and I looked up at the officers in the room.
I think the chief himself. I think he wants to assess the situation before anything's done," Butterworth was talking to Marino.
"Well, that's tough shit," Marino said. "And he shows up, he can stand out in the rain."
"How many people have been inside this room?" I asked.
"I don't know," one of the officers answered.
"If you don't know, then it's too many," I replied. "Did either of you touch the body? How close did you get to it?"
"I didn't touch her. No, ma'am."
"Whose footprints are these?" I pointed them out. "I need to know, because if they aren't yours, then the killer hung around long enough for the blood to dry."
Marino looked at the officer's feet. Both men were wearing black cross trainers.
Marino squatted and looked at the faint tread pattern on the hardwood floor.
"Could it be Vibram?" he sarcastically said.
"I need to get started," I said, getting swabs and a chemical thermometer out of my case.
"We got too damn many people in here," Marino announced. "Cooper Jenkins, go find something useful to do."
He jerked his thumb at the open doorway. They stared at him. One of them started to say something.
"Swallow it, Cooper," Marino told him, "and give me the camera. And maybe you followed orders by securing the scene, but you weren't told to work the damn scene." "What? Couldn't resist seeing your deputy chief like this? That the deal? How many other assholes been in here gawking?"
"Wait a minute," Jenkins protested.
Marino snatched the Nikon out of his hands.
"Give me a radio," Marino snapped.
Jenkins reluctantly detached it from his duty belt and handed that over to him, too.
"Go," Marino said.
"Captain, I can't leave without my radio. I just gave you permission." No one dared remind Marino that he had been suspended. Jenkins and Cooper left in a hurry.
"Sons of bitches," Marino declared in their wake.
I turned Bray's body on its side. Rigor mortis was complete, suggesting she had been dead at least 6 hours. I pulled down her pants and swabbed her rectum for seminal fluid before inserting the thermometer.
"I need a detective and some crime scene techs," Marina was saying on the air.
"Unit 9, what's the address?"
"The one in progress," Marino cryptically replied.
10-4, Unit 9, said the dispatcher, a woman.
"Minnie," Marino said to me.
I waited for an explanation.
"We go way back." "She's my radio room snitch," he said.
I withdrew the thermometer and held it up. 88.1, I said. "The body usually cools about 1.5 degrees an hour for the first 8 hours, but she's going to cool a little quicker because she's partially unclothed. It's, what, maybe 70 degrees in here?"
"I don't know, I'm burning up," he said. "For sure she was murdered last night, that much we know."
"Her stomach contents may tell us more," I said. "Do we have any idea how the killer got in?"
"I'm gonna check out the doors and windows after we finish up in here."
"Long, linear lacerations," I said, touching her wounds and looking for any trace evidence that might not make it to the morgue. "Like a tire iron. Then there are these punched-out areas, too, everywhere."
"Could be the end of the tire iron," Marino said, looking on.
"But what made this?" I asked. In several places on the mattress, blood had been transferred from some object that left a striped pattern reminiscent of a plowed field. The stripes were approximately 1.5 inches long, with maybe 1/8 of an inch of space between them. the total surface area of each transfer about the size of my palm.
"Make sure we check the drains for blood," I said, as voices sounded down the hall.
"Hope that's the breakfast boys," Marino said, referring to Ham and Eggleston.
They showed up carrying large pelican cases.
"You got any idea what the hell's going on?" Marino asked them.
The two crime scene technicians stared.
"Mother of God," Ham finally said.
"Does anyone have any idea what happened here?" Eggleston asked, his eyes fixed on what was left of Bray on the bed.
"You know about as much as we do," Marino replied. "Why weren't you called earlier?"
"I'm surprised you found out," Ham said. "No one told us until now."
"I got my sources," Marino said.
"Who tipped the media?" I asked.
"I guess they got their sources, too," said Eggleston.
He and Ham began opening the cases and setting up lights. Marino's unit number blared from his purloined radio, startling both of us.
"Shit," he mumbled.
"9,
he said over the air.
Ham and Eggleston put on gray binocular magnifiers, or Luke Skywalkers, as the cops called them.
"Unit 9, 10-5-314, the radio came back.
314, you out there?" Marino said.
"Need you to step outside," a voice returned.
"That's a 10-10, Marino said, refusing.
The techs began taking measurements in millimeters with additional magnifiers that looked rather much like jeweler's lenses. The binocular headsets alone could magnify only 3.5, and some blood spatters were too small for that.
"There's someone who needs to see you, now," the radio went on.
"Man, there's cast-off all over the place."
Eggleston was referring to blood thrown off during the backswing of a weapon, creating uniform trails or lines on whatever surface it impacted.
"Can't do it," Marino answered the radio.
314 didn't respond, and I unhappily suspected what this was all about, and I was right. In minutes, more footsteps sounded in the hall, and then Chief Rodney Harris was standing in the doorway, his face stone.
"Captain Marino," Harris said.
"Yes, sir, Chief,"
Marino studied an area of floor near the bathroom. Ham and Eggleston, in their black fatigues, latex gloves, and binocular headsets, only added to the cold horror of the scene as they worked with angles and axes and points of convergence to reconstruct, through geometry, where in space each blow was struck.
"Chief," they both said.
Harris stared at the bed, jaw muscles bunching. He was short and homely, with thinning red hair and an ongoing battle with his weight. Maybe these misfortunes had shaped him. I didn't know. But Harris had always been a tyrant. He was aggressive and made it obvious he didn't like women who strayed from their proper place, which was why I'd never understood his hiring Bray, unless it was simply that he thought she'd make him look good.
"With all due respect, Chief," Marino said, "don't step one damn inch closer."
"I want to know, did you bring in the media, Captain?"
Harris said in a tone that would have frightened most people I knew.
"Are you directly responsible for that, too? Or did you just directly counter my orders?"
"I guess it's the latter, Chief. I had nothing to do with the media. They was already here when the doc and I pulled up."
Harris looked at me as if he'd just now noticed I was in the room. Ham and Eggleston climbed up on their stepladders, hiding behind their task.
"What happened to her?" Harris asked me, and his voice faltered a little. "Christ."
He closed his eyes and shook his head. "Beaten to death with some sort of instrument, maybe a tool, we don't know," I said.
"I mean, is there anything—"
he started to say, and his iron facade was rapidly slipping away.
"Well," he cleared his throat, his eyes pinned to Bray's body. "Why would someone do this? Who? Anything?"
"That's what we're working on, Chief," Marino said. "Don't have a single damn answer right now, but maybe you can answer a few questions for me."
The crime scene techs had begun painstakingly taping bright pink surveyor's string above droplets of blood spattered on the white ceiling. Harris looked ill.
"You know anything about her personal life?" Marino asked.
"No," Harris said. "In fact, I didn't know she had one.
She had someone over last night. They ate pizza, maybe drank a little. Appears her guest smoked," Marino said.
I never heard her say anything about going out with someone.
Harris tore his attention away from the bed.
We weren't really what I'd call friendly with each other.
Ham stopped what he was doing, the string he held connected only to air. Eggleston peered up through his optivisor at blood droplets on the ceiling. He moved a measuring magnifier over them and wrote down millimeters.
What about neighbors? Harris then asked. Did anyone hear anything, see anything?
Sorry, but we ain't had time to canvass the neighborhood yet, especially since nobody called any detectives or techs until I finally did, Marino said.
Harris abruptly walked off. I looked at Marino and he avoided my eyes. I was certain he had just lost what was left of his job.
How are we doing here? He asked Ham. Already running out of shit to hang this on.
Ham taped one end of string over a blood droplet the size and shape of a comma.
Okay, so where do I tape the other end? How about you move that floor lamp over here? Thanks, set it right there.
Perfect, Ham said, taping the string to the lamp's finial.
You ought to quit your day job, Captain, and come work with us.
You would hate it, Eggleston promised. You got that right. Nothing I hate more than wasting my time,
Marino said. Stringing wasn't a waste of time, but it was a nightmare of tedium unless one was fond of protractors and trigonometry and had an anal-retentive mind. The point was that each droplet of blood has its individual trajectory from the impact site or wound to a target surface such as a wall, and depending on velocity, distance traveled, and angles, droplets have many shapes that tell a gory story. Although these days computers could come up with the same results, the scene work required just as much time, and all of us who had testified in court had learned that jurors would rather see brightly colored string in a tangible three-dimensional model than hatch lines on a chart. But calculating the exact position of a victim when each blow was struck was superfluous unless inches mattered, and they didn't matter here. I didn't need measurements to tell me this was a homicide versus a suicide, or that the killer had been enraged and frenzied and all over the place.
We need to get her downtown, I said to Marino. Let's get the squad up here.
I just can't figure how he got in, Ham said. She's a cop. You'd think she'd know better than to open the door to a stranger.
Assuming he was a stranger.
Hell, he's the same damn maniac who killed the girl in the quick carry. Gotta be.
Dr. Scarpetta.
Harris's voice came from the hall. I turned around with a start. I thought he was gone.
Where's her gun? Has anybody found it?
Marino asked.
Not so far. Could I see you for a minute, please?
Harris asked me. Marino threw Harris a dirty look and stepped into the bathroom, calling out a little too loudly,
"You guys know to check the drains and pipes, right?
We'll get there, boss."
I joined Harris in the hall, and he moved us away from the door where no one could hear what he had to say. Richmond's police chief had surrendered to tragedy. Anger had turned to fear, and that, I suspected, was what he didn't want his troops to see. His suit jacket was draped over an arm, his shirt collar open and tie loose. He was having a hard time breathing.
"Are you all right?" I asked.
"Asthma."
"You have your inhaler?"
"Just used it."
"Take it easy, Chief Harris," I calmly said, because asthma could get dangerous fast, and stress made everything worse.
"Look," he said, "there have been rumors that she was involved in certain activities in D.C. I didn't know anything about it when I hired her. Where she gets her money," he added, as if Diane Bray weren't dead. "And I know Anderson follows her around like a puppy."
"Maybe followed her when Bray didn't know it as well," I said.
"We've got her in a patrol car," he said, as if this were news to me.
"As a rule, it's not my place to voice opinions about who's guilty of murder," I replied. "But I don't think Anderson committed this one."
He got out his inhaler again and took two puffs. "Chief Harris, we've got a sadistic killer out there who murdered Kim Luong. The M.O. here is the same. It's too unique to be someone else. There aren't enough details known for it to be a copycat. Many details are known only by Marino and me."
He struggled to breathe.
"Do you understand what I'm saying?" I asked. "Do you want others to die like this? Because it will happen again, and soon. This guy's losing control at a lightning rate. Maybe because he left his safe haven in Paris and now he's like a hunted wild animal with no place to run? And he's enraged, desperate. Maybe he feels challenged and he's taunting us, I added, as I wondered what Benton would say. Who knows what goes on inside a mind like that? Harris cleared his throat. What do you want me to do? He asked. A press release, and I mean now. We know he speaks French. He may have a congenital disorder that results in excessive hairiness. He may have long, pale hair on his body. He may shave his entire face, neck, and head, and have deformed dentition, widely spaced, small, pointed teeth. His face is probably going to look odd, too. Jesus Christ. Marino needs to handle this, I told him, as if it were my right to do so. What did you say? We're supposed to tell the public we're looking for some man with hair all over his body and pointed teeth? You want to start a panic like this city's never seen? He couldn't catch his breath. Calm down, please. I put my fingers on his neck to check his pulse. It was running away with his life. I walked him into the living room and made him sit down. I brought him a glass of water and massaged his shoulders, talked quietly to him, gently coaxing him to be still until he was soothed and breathing again. You don't need the pressure of this, I said. Marino should be working these cases, not riding around in a uniform all night. God help you if he's not working these homicides. God help all of us. Harris nodded. He got up and moved in slow steps back to the doorway of that terrible scene. Marino was rooting around in the walk-in closet by now. Captain Marino, Harris said. Marino stopped what he was doing and gave his chief a defiant look. You're in charge, Harris said to him. Let me know if there's anything you need. Marino's gloved hands went through a section of skirts. I want to talk to Anderson, he said. 40. Renee Anderson's face was as hard and glazed as the glass she stared through when attendants carried Diane Bray's pouched body past on a stretcher and loaded it into a van. It was still raining. Dogged reporters and photographers poised like swimmers on blocks, all of them staring at Marino and me as we approached the patrol car. Marino opened Anderson's passenger's door and poked his head inside. We need to have a little chat, he said to her. Her frightened eyes jumped from him to me. Come on, Marino said. I've got nothing to say to her, she said, glancing at me. I guess the doc must think you do, Marino said. Come on, get out. Don't make me have to help you. I don't want them taking pictures, she exclaimed, and it was too late. Cameras were already on her like a storm of hurled spears. Just put your coat over your head to cover your face like you see on TV, Marino said with a trace of sarcasm. I walked over to the removal van to have a word with the two attendants as they shut the tailgate doors. When you get there, I said, as cold raindrops fell and my hair began to drip, I want the body escorted into the cooler with security present. I want you to contact Dr. Fielding and make sure he supervises. Yes, ma'am. And we don't talk about this to anyone, never do. But especially not this one. Not one word, I said. We sure wouldn't. They climbed inside the van and backed out as I walked to the house and paid no attention to questions and cameras and flashes going off. Marino and Anderson sat in the living room, and Diane Bray's clocks said it was 11:30 now. Anderson's jeans were wet, and her shoes were caked with mud and grass, as if she'd fallen down at some point. She was cold and trembling. "You know we can get DNA off a beer bottle, right?" Marino was saying to her. "We can get it off a cigarette butt, right? Hell, we can get it off a damn pizza crust." Anderson was slumped on the couch and didn't seem to have much fight left in her. "It's got nothing to do with," she started to reply. "Salem menthol butts in the kitchen trash," he continued his interrogation. "Believe that's what you smoke? And yeah, it does have to do with it, Anderson, because I believe you was here last night not long before Bray was murdered, and I also believe she didn't struggle, maybe even knew the person who beat the shit out of her back in the bedroom." Marino didn't believe for a nanosecond that Anderson had murdered Bray. "What happened?" he asked. "She tease you until you couldn't take it no more?"
I thought of the sexy satin blouse and lacy lingerie Bray had been wearing. She eat a little pizza with you and tell you to go on home like you was nothing to her? She diss you for the last time last night? Marino asked. Anderson silently stared down at her motionless hands. She kept licking her lips, trying not to cry.
I mean, it would be understandable. All of us can only take so much, isn't that right, Doc? Like when someone's fucking around with your career, just as an example. But we'll get to that part a little later.
He leaned forward in his antique chair, big hands on his big knees, until Anderson's bloodshot eyes lifted and met his.
You got any idea how much trouble you're in? He said to her.
Her hand shook as she pushed back her hair.
I was here early last night, she spoke in a flat, depressed voice. I dropped by and we ordered pizza.
This a habit of yours? Marino asked. To drop by, were you invited?
I would come over here. Sometimes I drop by, she said.
Sometimes you drop by unannounced. That's what you're saying.
She nodded, wetting her lips again.
Did you do that last night?
Anderson had to think. I could see yet one more lie condensing like a cloud in her eyes.
Marino leaned back in his chair. Damn, this is uncomfortable. He rolled his shoulders. Like sitting in a tomb. I think it might be a good idea to tell the truth, don't you? 'Cause guess what? I'm going to find out one way or other. And you lie to me, I'll bust your chops so bad you'll eat cockroaches in prison. Don't think we don't know about you and that goddamn rental car sitting out there.
There's nothing unusual about a detective having a rental car, she fumbled and knew it.
Sure as hell is if it's following people everywhere, he retorted.
And now it was my time to speak. You parked it in front of my secretary's apartment, I said.
Or at least somebody in that car did. I've been followed. Rose was followed.
Anderson didn't speak.
I don't suppose your email address would happen to be M-A-Y-F-L-R.
I spelled it out for her.
She blew on her hands to warm them.
That's right, I forgot, Marino said.
You was born in May, the 10th, in Bristol, Tennessee. I can tell you your social security number, address too if you want.
I know all about Chuck, I said to her.
Now she was getting very nervous and scared.
Fact is, Marino stepped in, we got old Chucky boy on tape stealing prescription drugs from the morgue. You know that?
She took a deep breath. We really didn't have that on tape yet.
A lot of money. Enough for him and you and even Bray to have pretty good lives.
He stole them, not me, Anderson spoke up. And it wasn't my idea.
You used to work in Vice, Marino replied.
You know where to unload shit like that. I just bet you were the mastermind of the whole fucking thing, because as much as I don't like Chuck, he wasn't a drug dealer before you appeared on the scene.
You were following Rose, following me, to intimidate us, I said.
My jurisdiction is the city, she said. I cruise all over the place. Doesn't mean I have some motive in mind if I'm behind you.
Marino got up and made a rude noise to voice his disgust.
Come on, he said to her. Why don't we just go on back to Bray's bedroom? Since you're such a good detective, maybe you can look at the blood and brains everywhere and tell me what you think happened. Since you weren't following no one and the drug dealing wasn't your fault, may as well get back to work and help me out here, Detective Anderson.
Her face got pale. Terror leapt through her eyes like scattering deer.
What? Marino sat next to her on the couch. You got a problem with that? That mean you don't want to go to the morgue and watch the autopsy either? Not eager to do your job?
He shrugged and got up again, pacing, shaking his head.
I tell you, it's not for weak stomach, that's for sure. Her face looks like hamburger.
Stop it!
And her breasts are chewed up so bad.
Anderson's eyes filled with tears, and she covered her face in her hands.
Like somebody wasn't getting their desires satisfied and just exploded in this sexual rage. A real lust-hate thing. And doing that to someone's face is usually pretty personal.
Stop it! Anderson screamed.
Marino got quiet, staring at her in a studious way as if she were a math problem written on a chalkboard.
Detective Anderson, I said, what was Deputy Chief Bray wearing when you came over last night?
A light green blouse,
sort of satiny?
Her voice trembled and caught.
Black corduroys, shoes and socks, ankle boots, black, and black socks.
Jewelry?
A ring and a watch.
What about underwear, a bra? She looked at me and her nose was running and she talked as if she had a cold. It's important I know these things, I said.
It's true about Chuck,
she said instead.
But it wasn't my idea. It was hers.
Bray's? I followed where she was going.
She took me out of Vice and put me in Homicide. She wanted you a million miles out of the way, she said to Marino. She's been making money off of pills and I don't know what all else for a long time, and she took a lot of pills, too, and she wanted you gone.
She returned her attention to me and wiped her nose on the back of her hand. I dug in my satchel and handed her tissues.
She wanted you gone, too, she said.
That's been rather obvious, I replied. And it didn't seem possible that this person we were talking about was the mauled remains I had examined moments earlier, but rooms away in the back of this house.
I know she had on a bra, Anderson then said. She used to always wear things, open neck or top buttons undone. And she would lean over so you could see down her shirt. She did it all the time, even at work, because she liked the reaction she got.
What reaction? Marino asked.
Well, people definitely reacted. And skirts with slits that looked normal unless you were sitting in her office with her and she'd cross her legs in certain ways. I told her she shouldn't dress like that.
What reaction? Marino asked again.
I told her all the time she shouldn't dress that way.
Takes a lot of nerve for a lowly detective to tell a deputy chief how to dress.
I didn't think officers should see her like that, look at her like that.
Made you a little jealous, maybe?
She didn't answer.
And I bet she knew it made you jealous, made you really squirm, just fucking miserable and mad, right? Bray got off on it. She's the type who would. Wind you up and then take your battery out so what you want don't go nowhere.
She had on a black bra, Anderson said to me. It had lace around the top. I don't know what else she had on.
She used the hell out of you, didn't she? Marino said. Made you her drug mule, gopher, little Cinderella on the hearth. What else she ask you to do?
Anger was beginning to warm up, Anderson.
She make you take her car to be washed? That was the rumor. She made you look like a sucking-up, moonstruck ass-kisser nobody took seriously. Sad thing is, maybe you wouldn't be such a shitty detective if she'd left you alone. You never even had a chance to find out, not with her keeping you on a leash the way she did. Let me tell you something. Bray was no more going to sleep with you than the man on the moon. People like her don't sleep with anybody. They're like snakes. They don't need nobody else to keep them warm.
I hate her, Anderson said. She treated me like dirt.
Then why'd you keep coming here? Marino asked.
Anderson fixed on me as if she hadn't heard Marino. She'd sit right in that chair where you are, and she'd make me get her a drink and rub her shoulders and wait on her hand and foot. Sometimes she wanted me to give her massages.
Did you? Marino asked.
She'd have on nothing but a robe and lie on that bed.
Same one she was murdered on? Did she take her robe off when you massaged her?
Anderson's eyes were blazing as they turned on him.
She always kept herself covered just enough. I took her clothes to the dry cleaner and filled her fucking Jaguar with gas, and she was so mean to me!
Anderson sounded like a child angry with her mother.
She sure was, Marino said. She was mean to a lot of people.
But I didn't kill her, good God! I never touched her except when she wanted me to, like I already told you.
What happened last night? Marino asked. You stopped by because you just had to see her?
She was expecting me. To drop off some pills, some money. She liked Valium, Ativan, Buspar, things that made her relax.
How much money?
$2,500, cash.
Well, it ain't here now, Marino said.
It was on the table in the kitchen. I don't know. We ordered pizza. We drank a little and talked. She was in a bad mood.
Over what?
She heard you'd gone to France, she said to both of us, to Interpol.
I wonder how she found that out.
Probably your office. Maybe Chuck found out. Who knows? She always got what she wanted, found out what she wanted. She thought she was the one who should have gone over there. To Interpol, I mean. That's all she would talk about.
and she started blaming me for all the screw-ups, like the restaurant parking lot, the email, the way things happened at the quick carry scene, just everything. The clocks all chimed and gonged. It was noon. "What time did you leave?" I asked when the concert stopped. "Maybe 9. "Did she ever shop at the quick carry?" "She may have dropped in there before," she replied. "But as you could probably tell from looking around her kitchen, she wasn't much into cooking or eating at home."
"And you probably brought in food all the time," Marino added.
"She never offered to pay me back. I don't make much money."
"What about that nice little allowance from prescription drugs?"
"I'm confused," Marino said.
"You saying you didn't get a fair cut?"
"Chuck and I got 10% each. I'd bring her the rest once a week, depending on what drugs came in. Into the morgue, or maybe if I got some from a scene. I never stayed long when I came over here. She was always in a hurry. Suddenly she had things to do. I have car payments. That's what my 10%'s gone to. Not like her. She doesn't know what it's like to worry about a car payment."
"You ever fight with her?" Marino asked.
"Sometimes. We'd argue."
"Did you argue last night?"
"I guess so. Over what?" "I didn't like her mood. Same thing."
"Then?"
"I left, like I said. She had things to do. She always decided when a discussion or argument was over."
"You driving the rental car last night?" Marino wanted to know.
"Yes." I imagined the killer watching her leave. He was there, somewhere in the dark. Both of them had been at the port when the Sirius had come in, when the killer arrived in Richmond using the alias of a seaman named Pascal. He probably saw her. He probably saw Bray. He would have been interested in all of those who had come to investigate his crime, including Marino and me. "Detective Anderson," I said, "did you sometimes come back here after you'd left to try to talk to Bray some more?"
"Yes," she confessed. "It wasn't fair for her to just push me out like that."
"You came back often, when I was upset.
What would you do, ring the bell? How did you let her know you were here?"
"What?" "It seems the police always knock, at least when they come to my house," I said. "They don't ring the bell."
"'Cause half the rat traps we go to don't have doorbells that work," Marino remarked.
"I knocked," she said. "And how would you do it?" I asked, as Marino lit a cigarette and let me talk.
"Well, twice, 3 times, hard, soft," I kept going.
"3 times, loud."
"And she would always let you in?"
"Sometimes she wouldn't. Sometimes she'd just open the door and tell me to go home."
"Did she ask who was there? Anything?"